the number one hit music station. More music, more variety. Welcome to The Alternative. Playing today's new country. Oh, sorry, I was just practicing. I'm Matt from Matt Fogarty Voiceovers. I know you want to listen to your podcast, so I'm going to keep this super brief. If you're a program director and you're looking for a fresh sound on your station, hit me up. I'll do a free, no-obligation sample for you, and you can get a really good sense for how I'll sound on your station. Get in touch at mattfogartyvo.com. I'm seriously sitting by my computer hitting refresh right now. Email me. Do it.
The Sound Off Podcast. The podcast about broadcast with Matt Kundle. Starts now.
Sharon Hyland is one of ShowmFM's longest-serving air talent. She's been there 25 years. It's a tremendous accomplishment, and I really enjoyed my time working alongside her. And every time I listen to the station and hear Sharon, I know I'm back at home listening to Shom. When the story of Shom is finally written, it will include names from six decades like Doug Pringle, Rob Braid, Angus MacKay, Bobby Beauchamp, Peppermint Patty, Terry DeMonte, Too Tall, and Sharon Hyland. What follows is us catching up. Sorry if this feels just a little inside at times. All that's missing from this talk are drinks at Ziggy's on Crescent Street. Sharon Hyland joins me from her home in Montreal.
Sharon, where did we first meet?
It was a bar on Crescent. No. It had to have been in the building when we moved to Fort Street from Green Avenue.
What a shitty time to meet, because I know there was a lot going on at that time, especially for Shom, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was what we heard from our neighbors down the dial referred to as Black Valentine's, oh no, the Valentine's Day Massacre. So I suppose I survived the Valentine's Day Massacre.
So if we wind it right back, did you always know that you wanted to get into radio?
I think I always knew I wanted to do something music related because I love music so much and knowing stuff about music and talking to other people like that. But I was pretty shy. I would have considered myself shy. I would bet that anybody that knows me now or would say, really, you're shy? But I was shy. I wouldn't have had, or at least I wasn't 100% confident when I needed to be for myself. And I think that that's one of the great lessons that radio has taught me, is that no one's going to fight as hard for you as you will for yourself.
Did Shom play a big role in that music discovery? You mentioned you got in because of the music. What percentage do you sort of accredit that to Shom or to any other form of radio?
Well, for me, I was, I guess, technically late to the Shom game. But Shom had that elusive coolness to it. So it was there. But as far as my formation of music appreciation, that certainly came from CKGM and Ralph Lockwood and Mark Denis and those guys.
Steve Anthony?
Steve Anthony's impact on me as a fan was greater for his time at Much Music. And then meeting and working with him later on when he came back to radio in Montreal, that was kind of cool. Because he's such a nice guy. He's like a bundle of energy, but he's super bright and he totally knows what he's doing. He's got just a cool voice. It's so identifiable. So it was neat to be at least professionally aligned with that for however long.
I mentioned that because in 1982, when I was listening to CKGM, Steve had this unique voice. I think may have been the evening jock at the time, but I remember just listening to him and loving CKGM. So I'm glad that you mentioned that you got your musical joy from that radio station.
Well, the fun kind of zoo-like morning show that was, I think that isn't necessarily in place that much in many places now, was what Ralph Lockwood gave to everybody's morning. So when you got to school, you were listening to the music, your parents were trying to listen to CJD to see if the snowstorm was closing your school or not. And so everybody had that kind of access to the same information. So it was neat. And also, I remember my parents, again, the CJD coming off of the clock radio that happened to be in the kitchen. And hearing Joe Cannon, but he wasn't on CJD at that time, was he? Anyways, Joe Cannon.
George Balkan or Joe Cannon?
Joe Cannon, because I'm friends with his son. So I remember hearing, like in grade three, that, my boy's going as Johnny Bench. So I knew ahead of going to school that day on Halloween, in my Halloween costume, what Jared was going to be, which I thought was really cool. Like, I've got the information and I'm bringing it to school.
There was a lot more Montreal radio that you could choose from back then, and it was probably a lot wider between, you know, CFCF and CJAD and CKGM on the AM dial, and, you know, on FM there was CFQR 92.5, but that was sleepy time elevator music.
Oh my gosh. You can hear music today and go, that's CFQR, you know, like that string section, even the Carpenters, which are lovely to hear because they're so well produced and their harmonies are spectacular. But it takes you right back to your parents' radio, which I have a real soft spot for because it's such a huge part of my formation as a fan of music.
Did you have 45s? Did you have full-length albums or cassettes?
Oh, yeah. I had them all. More 45s than albums. And then I joined Columbia House because who didn't? How could you resist that, right? Shipping. All you have to pay is shipping. And then we'll charge you 1 cent for 4,000 cassettes. So that's where you get your Steve Miller's Greatest Hits and your Doobie Brothers' Greatest Hits and the Eagles' Greatest Hits. And you dive into this whole genre of music that somewhat predates you as a music fan, because I guess I was like 6 when they were hitting their stride, but that it felt like this collection of music at my fingertips. So yeah, but I would also go to record stores at the mall. There was a family-owned record store just like a 10-minute walk from us that I would go to, and I'd buy 45s because I love the idea of, look at this. I mean, it's not the gift that keeps on giving because it's just the 2 songs, but it was neat. And it seemed very in line, at least with kind of a radio mentality. All you were getting was from CKGM were the hit songs. So you had to buy the hit songs.
So do you have a favorite B-side of all those 45s? Like one time where you turn the 45 over and then you heard the song and said, this is really, really good.
Yeah. My knee-jerk memory, I think, on that question, which brother could derail this whole conversation because I could get trapped in thought, was a Kool & the Gang song. That too, that was like the great discovery option of, hey, nobody knows about this one, but as if, like, it was also on the album. It just wasn't going to be the single. Yeah, there's some great stories in like even Beatles history or Beach Boys history where the DJ played the wrong side and, oh, that's going to be the hit. Cool reference to the power of the 45.
What was on the A side? Was it Celebration?
It would have been that era. Kool & the Gang are such a cool band just because they're so... There's so many moving parts. I'm intrigued by the notion of that many moving parts and having it all seem so perfect and flawless.
Even a song like later on in the 1980s, around 1984, like a song like Misled, I found to be terribly polished and really good in the years later. I think I just let my Spotify roll and it popped on. I said, oh, yeah, I've forgotten how polished this is.
Isn't it amazing, eh? Spotify, that it's all there. And I think of myself and my age and how I'm pleased by the fact that it's all there, but there's a generation after me or two that this is all they've ever known, that it's just all there. So you wonder if they really truly appreciate what they have.
Well, do you remember the old days where somebody would call the radio station and you would have to go on a treasure hunt through the Shom library to go find the song the person was looking for so they could write it down and possibly go out and buy it, or maybe you play it on the radio?
Oh gosh, imagine that, eh? The fun thing about people when we're on the air and when we hear from people that are requesting songs, it still means as much to people to get their song played.
When did you know you wanted to be in radio, and how did you go about getting on the radio when it came to going to school?
I think I knew I wanted to be on the radio when I was young, but like I said, the confidence thing got in the way. And then I got to CJEP and I thought, oh, there's a radio station at John Abbott. Let's see about getting in there. And to get into the courses that aligned themselves with doing that route, you needed a placement card. So when we would register back then, you'd have to go there and you're looking at a giant board with 1,000 classes. And you're like, okay, I think that one's going to fit my schedule. You go and you go, oh, no, we're closed. And, oh, you need a place card for that. But I didn't have the confidence to go, well, where do I get this placement card? What's my next step? So it was a block to me, big enough to go, oh, okay. And so then I ended up going over here. So had I been confident enough to go, well, where do I get it? What's next? I got to get on. This is me. I was never that person. So it ended up that I went back to school at 23-ish, 24-ish. And I went and I studied at Algonquin College. I applied to the program, did an entrance exam. At that time, they would get 300 applicants and take 30. So I got in. I'm like, oh, well, that's cool. Like I had to go there and take an exam, actually write one and just sort of test your knowledge and see what sort of aptitude you had and what kind of vision you had for yourself in and out of the program. And I got in. So I'm like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And then there was another girl at that time who was around my age, another guy that was a little bit older, but everybody else was 18 or 20. And they were all like, let's go to the bar. And I was like, I did that already. I'm paying for school now, so I'm actually going to go to the class and I'm probably going to do the work. And it was great. And it was 2 years of really hard work doing all kinds of different things. They didn't like lead us down the wrong path at all, because within the first couple of weeks, they told us that most of you will not get a job in radio. And we're like, super, this is week two. What's next then? So it basically plants the seed that you got to work. And beyond the work that you're doing here, you're going to have to work for yourself and push and go after what you want and be your best advocate. So I did that. And at the end of the program of 2 years, throughout the whole time I worked at a CD store, which was like a jackpot after spending as much time as I did at Discus or whatever. And seeing the people that work there as celebrities, I thought, this is the coolest thing. I'm working at a record store. And I was old enough to know that I needed a job, but fully appreciate the job that I had. And after the two-year program finished, we had our graduation ceremony. And the next day after the grad, I had an interview at Shea 106 in Ottawa to do their overnights on the weekend. And one of my classmates had been doing it and realized that it wasn't for him. He couldn't do the schedule. I was shocked by that because he was one of the older students and seemed like he was on the right track to do great things. And it seemed really sudden. I thought, whoa, I'm applying for this guy's job. And what's going to happen to him? What's he doing? He's reaching this crossroads in his career that's just 4 minutes old, you know? Anyways, I got the job and I spent 2.5 years in Ottawa. I did weekend overnight, but I worked up to weekend evenings. And filled in on other shifts and stuff like that. So it was super fun.
And some legendary names in that building, too.
Yeah.
Steve Caldwell,
one of my favorite bosses. I mean, he set the bar for what bosses should be. And few have reached that, in my estimation.
Janet Eastman?
Yep. She was doing evenings at that time.
That's all I got for Shea 106.
Do you know Mike Junta?
Mike Junta, of course.
Well, Mike Junta was a teacher of mine at Algonquin. He taught music appreciation, which was a class. And I thought, I am totally in the right program if this is one of the courses. And he was also the music director at Shea 106 and assistant program director. So I think he put in a good word for me.
And just for time reference, that's the part of the 1990s where it really runs fairly unopposed on the FM dial when it comes to rock radio. I think 54 Rock was going at that time.
Yeah. So it was us against an AM rock station, but they held firm and then they moved to FM and they were the bear. So that was a direct attack, which was kind of cool because it's good to have competition.
How did you acquire confidence over the years? You mentioned you weren't confident. I think that would surprise a lot of people who listen to you today on the radio. It kind of surprised me when you told me. But at the same time, I know that with all the people that we work with, there were people who have, I think, shy by nature. But did that change for you from that time that you were registering for school at John Abbott? Is confidence something that you acquired along the way? And how did you do it? And what was in the bottle?
You know what? I think that you end up tiring of seeing other people get the things that you want. And they're not getting it over you necessarily. In some cases, they are. But you want more for yourself. And you realize that the only way that you're going to get it is if you get it. So if you stick doing what you're doing, you're not going to get it. It's like a pushing of yourself out of your comfort zone for sure. But it's like a trial and error. You try it and you see what happens. You try something different. You go for a different result. What's that? The definition of insanity is trying the same thing to get a different result.
Over and over and over again.
Over and over. And eventually it doesn't work. So
how did you land at Shulm?
Well, toward the end of the final semester of Algonquin College, you have to go and get an internship. And Algonquin's in Ottawa. And I thought, everybody's going to the stations here. I'll see if I can get in at Shulm in Montreal. No one's going there. My mom lived here. I had somewhere to stay. So I came here. Ian McLean helped me set up an internship. And I was responsible for assembling that birthday book. I'm not sure if you remember that. Real important work. I did anything anybody asked, which was really cool. So I was able to sort of watch people do what they do. I remember distinctly the way Pete worked, Pete Marrier, who I've known my whole life. He's got insane energy, right? Watching him work in a way that being on the air could somehow contrast the way he is in conversation, which could be jittery, could be like hyper kid. But then he gets on the air and he is smooth and he knows exactly where he's going. He knows exactly how he's going to get there, even if he doesn't. Do you know what I mean? So watching that was like, hey, okay, I can take that and see if I can try that myself. So he was helpful, whether or not he knew that, I'm not sure, but super helpful in being able to watch someone do it and not be weirded out by somebody staring at them while they're doing what they're supposed to be doing.
You said you'd known him your whole life, like even before you went to show him?
Yeah, yeah. Our families knew each other. He grew up next door to my aunt and my uncle and my cousins. So when we would go visit, they were there. One of my cousins' best friend is Pete's brother, Mike. And my sister went to school with his brother, Bob. It's a nice West Island story.
Yeah, actually, it sounds fairly dysfunctional because I'm thinking of the Highland girls and I'm thinking of the Marier boys. And
trouble, yeah.
That's trouble.
Yeah, but it wasn't. We were all very good.
So what was your first on-air shift at Shome?
My first on-air shift at Shome was like a trial run, actually, because Ian had brought me in to audition me. So I did an overnight. And Marty Lamar was doing it at that time, and he was helping me to op because they had just switched over to that computer system.
That would be Winnipeg's own Media Touch.
That had so many glitches at that time, so I was really appreciative that Marty was there.
Yeah, I was there for the install of that. And I think I did about 2 months on it before I had left. And it was the first of its kind. I think Chum got a deal and we're beta testing it.
It was a cool system.
And by the way, the very solid version that everyone uses today was based on that. But a couple of times I started to do things and I called Ian and I said, I think I got blackjack.
You could see that everybody had the same experience with that system and they had their own little tricks. So somehow the touch screen wouldn't read your fingers. So everybody would hit the table or hit the side of the screen and then touch it. So it almost like got blood to your fingertip, made it hot and made it work somehow.
And there was those who would lick their fingers to do it too.
Well, of course, they would not do that today, but it explains a lot knowing that.
Yeah. So we went from this great mixer board in this tiny room to this huge big room with no mixer board and only a touchscreen with like sliders to use. So
two. Remember, there was just two. One for the mic and one for the whatever else.
Boy, that didn't work. And then, by the way, I moved to Edmonton right after where they had the same thing, which did work, but just marginally better.
So you must have been a star.
Well, they had better engineers in Edmonton in that particular case, and nothing against Denny and Claude. Love you guys, but totally understand what was going on at the time. But man, that did not work. And of course, there was one evening announcer, Paul Beauregard, who announced he was colorblind and couldn't see half of it.
Oh, no. Classic Paul.
Love you, Uncle Paulie. Love you. So you and I had missed each other by about probably a year.
Yeah. But I remember hearing your name, obviously.
Well, I owed a lot of people money.
Yeah. And then it was long enough ago that you just heard how people were doing pre any social media commitment to knowing exactly how everybody's doing. This was like, oh yeah, I heard from Matt. And, oh yeah, did you know Matt? He's doing this now. So that was really cool. It's a great example of radio, I think. Word spreads. So it was nice to hear that you were doing as well as you were.
How do you sum up Shome in the 1990s? I was there to about late 1994, and I found it was starting to get complicated, but then it got even more complicated from 95 right through to 2000. I mean, musically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I started in 96, so I was feeling real proud. My first job was middays because Eden Polansky went on maternity leave. So her daughter, I think, is getting set to celebrate her 25th birthday, which is kind of cool. The weird relationship with, I guess, our PD and the music, and then our PD with the music director, who was trying to do his job, and the rest of us who were trying to represent, as you hope you do at a rock station, represent what people want to hear and stuff like that. But I remember our boss stopping us playing Rush at that time, leaning more pop than rock at its root, which was too bad because there was a lot of really good things happening in the 90s, rock-wise, that eventually he came around some. It predates me, but I know that at the time we weren't playing Nirvana when it came out.
No, that predates me. And I think the person who best tells the story is Kevin Shea, who was dressed up as the baby that this baby needs a home at Shome. and camped outside of 1310 Green Avenue in order to get it played. It's true that in the 1990s, Shome was not swift and missed a lot of records. When I got there, Under the Bridge did not get played. There was stuff that just got missed.
But it sounds like saying that it got missed sounds like it was a mistake. It was a mistake, but it was actively missed. Like, they would have had to have said no, which is a problem.
Yes, correct. It's a station that I think was very beholden to Supertramp and Doobie Brothers records.
Which is fine, because we still are. But we happen to play now. There's room for everything, as we've learned, you know?
I thought it was problematic when Ken Connors told me that he'd never played Jeremy in 1993. Because it was middays and the song was just day-parted out of his show.
And I find that interesting, too, the day-parting. The predetermining of what the audience is prepared to hear, you know, versus what they actually want to hear. What we're telling them that they want to hear versus what they actually want to hear. The same boss, and I've mentioned this on the air before because it makes me laugh, the same boss that didn't want two songs played back-to-back by female artists, because that's what they're going to think, that's all we play. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, by today's standards, it's ridiculous, and day-parting is ridiculous, and a whole bunch of things that I think we did back in the 90s were truly ridiculous. I get it that you don't want to play John Mellencamp and Bruce Springsteen back-to-back because they'll think that we're only playing.
But will they think that? Will they? Because I would think that their attention span in 2021 is shorter than it would have been in 1990 or 95 or whatever. But maybe it's not even shorter now. The implication is that we've got to make sure that we're hitting our marks, make sure that if they happen to be tuning in that moment, that we are representing what we do, which I am fully behind. But if it comes to a point where you have so narrowed your offering to make it seem like that's all you play to the person that's actually listening at work 9 to 5, who's pulling his hair out going, how come I'm hearing this again? Who are we serving? Are we serving the people that actually listen a long time? Or a new listener that might actually think all we play is John Mellencamp and Bruce Springsteen back to back? It's a weird balance.
By the way, this was not the only station that did this.
Oh no, everybody did that.
Yeah, a lot of successful radio stations were run like this because you could control it. It was one of the only things you could control were the things that you thought people cared about. That's it. That's why they did it. Today, I wouldn't even think twice about any of that stuff. Just go ahead and play it. I don't even think anybody thinks like that with some of the stuff I've heard on radio.
And I'm in this really fortunate position with my weekend show, The Building Blocks of Rock, where I have 2 hours that I fill. I don't like to talk about it too much because it's almost like it's this little secret that someone's going to find out and go, no, you don't anymore. But I've been doing this for 10 years now, and I'll push, you know, and maybe play something that I have too tall in the back of my head going, we never played that. And that's fine, but it doesn't mean that people aren't familiar with the song. And what I try to make sure to do is that if I do something that maybe seems a little over here, then I'll quickly remind that actually, okay, we also did this. So it contextualizes it in a way that makes it very fine in my ear.
Ian McLean was the boss throughout the 1990s. I didn't really start to empathize with what he had to go through until I became a program director. And then when things did get hard and you had to make some decisions and you had people up the chain, the company was Chum in Toronto. And that was a group that I don't think understood Montreal at all. And I think it made his job of programming very, very difficult. It made programming Shome very difficult throughout that period as well.
And it's interesting because all it takes is spending some time here and maybe even not spending time here, but spend time listening to what you're trying to control in a different way. So it would be easier for a program director to say, it's different here. If they're saying that, if they're telling you it's different here, then you have to acknowledge, okay, well, maybe it's different there. Let's hear why and take some time. But there's always that go-to of, you know, oh, head office is in Toronto, so that's all they know, and they're just going to tell us what to do. But there were people that fought for the radio station and fought for the city at the same time to identify as, well, here's what we're doing, and here's why it's different from Toronto or anywhere west of us or east of us. Everybody's different.
I think there is a mentality that every market is different, but memo to everybody listening to this right now, Montreal is the one that is really, 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 really different. Like, you have no idea how different it is until you get there. In fact, you may not even want to stay there because it's different. or you may live there forever because it's different.
There's a lot to offer for sure. And culturally, it seems like we can broad stroke it by saying we all have such great taste in music. Like, there are many different bands that come through Montreal that love Montreal and the fans. For Chaume especially, it's the Genesis, the Supertramps, the Yes, the progressive rock bands that got played on Chaume before anywhere else. Styx and the famous idea that they would come and sell out the Forum in Montreal and then continue their tour doing club dates elsewhere in North America. So they remember it. That's why when they come back to Montreal, they remember. And they remember that Chaume is attached to that. So that's pretty big. And that's a good sell. I once went to, remember that trip to Chicago to see Peter Gabriel? I went with Kayla Ellman and there was an interview. And then I called Terry and Ted the next morning after being at this interview and then going to the show that night, and super cool. And there was other media from across North America that came to this Q&A with Peter Gabriel in this big room, and everybody had to identify themselves, who they were and where they were from, what radio station. So ahead of that, I was talking to this little group of people from different spots and saying, well, you know what? Genesis were big in Montreal first. And I wasn't being super braggy. I was just making conversation with people and aligning myself with other radio people and saying, and you know, they were big in Montreal first. And it was actually at the radio station where I work that played them first. So, and they're like, yeah, right. You know, they were being polite and listening to what I was saying. And then when I said that part about it was our radio station that broke them kind of thing, they're like, oh, sure. Okay, whatever. So then it came time to ask our questions and going through the room. And when it came time, I was Sharon Hyland from Chaume FM in Montreal. And Peter Gabriel looked at me and did this. Oh, yeah. Like the knowing nod is what I called it. I asked my questions. On we go. And then after it was all done, the people that were like, yeah, right, were like, oh, my God, he totally knew who you were. He knew the station. I'm like, I told you. So they remember. And that's, again, making Montreal different.
Yeah, it's so cool that Christa Berg being another one of them, but they all can draw their early days. Dennis DeYoung, you know, friend of the radio station, calls up, participates on the morning show when he can. They can all draw the early days of their career back to this one radio station.
It's amazing. It's such a neat feeling. I've had the opportunity over the years when Roger Hodgson has come to do his solo stuff to intro most of the shows when he comes. So you get to chat with him in the back and it's like talking to someone you've known forever. I'd only met him officially by introing these shows. He's this really nice person who appreciates that you're there to intro his show. It's super old school, but oh my gosh, it's heartwarming. It's amazing.
Yeah, I was mentioning about Ian McLean and some of the odd decisions that he would have to arrive at because he was told to. I guess Howard Stern being one of them and coming on the radio. People can't see this because it's a podcast, but your face just drooped down. And it was almost like a baby pooped its pants with the face that you just made.
Well, it represents Howard Stern's beginnings represent my contract end. So I was away from the station for a little while, a couple of months, and then I came back. But it was all in line with his starting and the contract actually ending and the way the moves that they made to move things around, which for my own life worked out perfectly just because of stuff that was going on with my mom and stuff. But then listening to this show and how it's so, it was like the polar opposite of what we've just been saying, which is that connections made through music and this aligning themselves with their favorite radio station and that kind of approach. And then this guy comes in, and no disrespect to him because he's obviously great at what he does, but it wasn't for Chaume, that's for sure.
No, it disrupted the core audience and calling out French people. I mean, the audience is 70% French, and calling French Canadians cowards and whatnot is never going to go over well.
He's the kind of personality, or he was at that time, where if you said, you know what, you might want to steer clear of that, he was like, oh, you might, okay, I'll do it exactly as you said I should steer clear, I'll do it. Like he would go in head first just to be a shit disturber.
Did the arrival of Howard Stern mean a shift change for you?
Yes.
So you went from a full-time gig to weekends, or?
Yeah, eventually on to weekends. And I think I'm having this memory of, I sort of was put over there for a little while. And then when it happened, there was an announcer that was working weekends that didn't like the idea of not talking as much. I guess our PD at the time called him on the air and said, you know, you want to trim the brakes or whatever. So he took offense to that. and didn't talk at all. Just played music, didn't talk. And then when he decided to talk, he called RPD live on the air and said, I don't think this is what the listener wants, because I think the listener wants to hear some talking. And it was super awkward and uncomfortable and compelling. The cassette, someone burned it onto a CD eventually, but that made the rounds of, did you hear this? And it actually turned out to be interesting radio. It certainly lost him his job, certainly. And because of that, that's when I came back from over there and was put back on weekends.
How come that's not circulating the internet? I've forgotten about that. I heard that when it circulated on cassette. Why is that not on the internet?
And this was long enough ago where it would have, email was still new. And as the legend goes, from one of the producers in the building at the time, who had a friend who worked in small town Ontario, where I guess this announcer had a plan to go and apply anyways the following week, the email got to the PD or got to someone in whatever department who walked through the reception area with the printed email in their hands, saw the person in the waiting room, and walked to the PD and said, I think this is who is waiting in the reception area. Like, it's such a great story. I don't know if it happened that way, but it makes complete sense that it would, that you would get an email and print it, first of all, and have that sort of all storm at the same time for this poor young man.
In just a second, the struggles of managing your manager. The difficulty of programming an Anglophone radio station in a Francophone culture. Coming out without actually coming out. And how cancer has touched her life. As always, there's more stories on the episode page at soundoffpodcasts.com.
25 catalogs, over 2,000 albums, 61,000 songs, 197,000 tracks. Megatracks has everything you need to create the perfect sounds for your station, podcast, or digital program. Our flagship catalog, Megatracks, has hundreds of albums covering a huge array of genres and styles. Deep East Music and No Sheet Music deliver international sounds straight out of London. Sensacion brings an authentic Latin flair to every album and is recorded live by local musicians. Megatracks also has a huge collection of FFX, sound design, and narration mixes to give you full creative freedom to make any type of production imaginable. Head on over to Megatracks.com or call us at 818-255-7100 for your music licensing requests. That's Megatracks.com.
Just before we start the show, I want to thank Matt Fogarty, one of our great supporters, who is the imaging voice for great radio stations like Froggy 99.9 Fargo, North Dakota, MyFM, which can be heard across Ontario, and the legendary Oz FM in St. John's, Newfoundland. If you want to have Matt Fogarty be a part of your station, reach out to him at mattfogartyvo.com.
The Sound Off Podcast.
You mentioned your mom. Your family has been touched by cancer a few times. Generic and cliche question, but how has it affected you? Because your mom, two sisters?
My father first, my mother, and my older sister. My other sister is still fine.
Who's the one who passed?
Lori. She had breast cancer, and Debbie is my other sister. Debbie is alive and well.
I've met Debbie.
Yes, you have.
I love Debbie.
I do too.
What sort of lasting mark does it leave on you when you have such immediate family die of cancer? I mean, more than half your family.
Well, I think that you go back to the shy and the finding your confidence. You certainly have to find your confidence because you're faced with instant examples of things not lasting as long as you'd like. So you A, make the best of your situation and try to make sure that everybody knows how you feel about them. I think that's top of the list. Don't waste time. Appreciate moments. All the cliche things are cliches for a reason. It's because someone's gone through them and realized, hey, I shouldn't have wasted time not saying that I love them or whatever. So I'm pretty open with the love cards. But the association that I have with my mom and my career is that when it came time for me to be put over here for a moment, my mom was sick. Her cancer had come back. So at that time, selfishly, I would have loved a distraction called, you know, work. But she needed me and we needed to take care of her in that way. So timing wise, it was meant to be. It happened the way it was supposed to.
Fast forward into the year 2000 and beyond, and we approach the Black Friday Valentine's Massacre.
Line them up and knock them down.
So good news, bad news. And the good news is that Standard Radio buys Shulm. And the bad news is for those of the people who are there, a number of people are not going to have their jobs. I think that was inevitable that it was going to roll out like that. And listen, it was certainly weird for me to leave Shulm, come back, and then see many of the people that I had worked with. You know, I get a week with them and then we're laying them off.
Yeah, it was strange. I was doing middays on Green, and during my shift, during the show, heading into the electric lunch hour, I had my scheduled meeting with the bosses, which I thought was curious. I have not yet questioned Rob Braid on that move. Like, why wouldn't you wait till 2 when I was done, if we know that all the bad crap is coming? I kind of asked him in the moment. So what I remember about that, it was coming off the air, lining up a few songs, and then going in. I might have voice tracked a break or something. Going into this meeting, being told what I was told, which was that we'd like to keep you, but you won't be on middays. We're going to put you on weekends. I was stunned, but happy that I had a job still, which is how they get you or keep you. In the meeting, I was about to get up and I said, what makes you think I'm not going to go back and lose it on the air? Like, having this meeting now, why would you? And Rob Braid, who I love, said, well, we know that you're a professional and you won't do that. Like, simply stated, I'm like, you're right. I won't. Okay. So I went back and I finished the shift. And I think I was able to tell them in that, the listeners in that moment, that the changes were coming and all that. But what I also remember is coming out of that office and having the executive assistant to our GM at the time, I came out and she was standing there like it was her turn to go into the den. I'm like, this is heavy. And I went back and I finished the shift off and was like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm happy I made it.
I'm thinking back to the people that were kept on. So you were kept on. Tutal was kept on. And Pete was kept on, but then chose not to stay.
Yeah. There was a couple of maybe traffic people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Olga and Keith.
Oh, yeah. And Keith just retired a couple of years ago, but Olga's still there. Everybody's separate, though. We're not in the same building at all. But it's interesting to be a part of that because I've been a part of a few of those. And you always think that, wow, hope I don't have to go through that again. And then you do, because that's the nature of the business.
Well, that one was a strange one because everybody knew each other and it was, you know, Standard sort of gobbling up Chum. We all knew each other.
And we were competitive against where we were. And now we had to go in and be friends with everybody. Not that we didn't like them, but like, wait a minute, now we're all related? Okay. Like families coming together. So we were stepbrothers and sisters.
And so speaking of flipping back and forth, you flip back to doing weekends. Again, it was what, 3 or 4 years again before you'd gone back to getting a full-time gig and doing middays?
Ahead of middays, I did evenings and then middays again. I think I was on evenings for like 5 years and I loved it. Because at that time I was doing evenings, but also assistant music director to you for a time. And then you left. And then I was assistant music director to Ray Scott.
Did you have fun programming music?
I liked it a lot. I liked doing it. I appreciated what went into it. Your brain for that job, I really respected because it was a lot. So like if you weren't there and I was filling in and whatever, I knew that a lot had gone in because I knew what I had to bring in your absence. But there's a capacity that's required to do that job that I don't think people fully understand. But thankfully, there are people like you that do understand.
So did it do anything to answer the questions of why we don't play like Bruce Springsteen and John Mellencamp back to back?
No, because I would still argue that. And I think a full circle back to the confidence thing is being able to have those discussions, debates, let's say, on why it would be okay. Discussions is good. Discussions won't get you fired, ideally. But I think of another boss who I know that you have spoken to.
Oh, why can't we just name names?
Bob Harris. I remember a moment where as the assistant music director at that time, on Saturday nights, we had an 80s show and it was super fun and people liked it and it was fun to program. And Randy was the host of it, Randy Renault. And he decided, Randy thought it would be a good idea if we did, you know, the top 80 songs. We'll do a poll and then we'll rate them and it'll be the top 97 songs, whatever. So did it over the course of three weekends, I think, three Saturday nights, and people had voted, and it was a big deal. Keeping in mind that the 80s show ran between 8 and 11 p.m. on Saturday nights. So not really high traffic listening, but appointment tuning, because the people that, were having house parties or whatever, we heard back from them that they were listening. So it was effective. It was a great soundtrack for a Saturday night, but it wasn't like where you were selling your most expensive advertising on the station, right? So that said, we were getting closer and closer to the weekend that it would be the number one being played. And I had a moment of pride, which I realize, manage your pride. Just be happy with yourself. Don't say anything. This is what I've learned from this situation, because in the moment of pride, I said to Bob, who was in his office, which was right across from my little desk area, which was right across from yours, I said, oh, it's really cool. We're getting to the number one song. And the number one song by votes, I believe, was going to be How Soon Is Now by the Smiths, which makes complete sense to anybody else. To Bob, that was a giant red flag somehow. The number two or three song was Simple Minds, Someone Somewhere in the Summertime. Classic Montreal song. Not to Bob, who was like, what is this? And I'm not sure what had happened in his day to make him trigger this negative response, but he was not having it that this was going to be the top three songs of the 80s on this radio station, voted by listeners, by the way. So as he's shouting from his office, because I'm like, well, it's voted and this is what's happening. And he accused me of giving him tone, which I might have been, but I don't think I was disrespectful to my boss. I was sort of like in disbelief that I was having this conversation. He said, this can't be. I'm like, well, it was voted. And in it, I'm like, never say anything again. Don't be proud out loud. You know what I mean? Because look what's happening. As he's saying, what is this? Someone somewhere in the summertime. Mark Stafford has now walked out of his studio from down the hall to the printer, which is in front of Bob's office and near my desk. As he's saying, what is this? Mark Stafford said, ah, classic Simple Minds song, and just walks right back to his office. I'm like, thank you. Bob was like, no, wasn't having it. So changed the outcome. And the number one song, according to him, was Sunday Bloody Sunday. So I would have no problem telling Bob that story again, because he's probably not remembered it. Why would he? But it was like a great moment of, oh my God, what is happening? Don't be so sure of yourself to brag next time about how happy you are with the show that you guys have put together.
Again, it goes back to what we said earlier. It is a unique market, and it is very difficult to come from away to program in this place. And I've had some very nice conversations with some very nice research people over the years. And by the way, thank you. I love the research people. A lot of stations didn't get money for it. We did. But when the testing number for Babe Ruth the Mexican comes back at 99, they got it. A score of 99 on that research means you put that in A and you play it 10 times a week on a rock station easily.
Isn't that amazing? And you know what? I have heard, like I said, Bob Harris on this podcast with you. And I heard him say, it took me a couple of years to realize that Montreal was different. That story must have happened in the middle of those couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And Montreal is very, very difficult to explain. You have to live it. And Bob and I worked well together because I could explain it to him. And I think he had a lot of confidence in me when I said, we got to go with this. So I'm sorry I wasn't there to referee that particular one. I'd already left, but there were a few of them. And it wasn't just Bob. It was a lot of people who'd come from afar. I've seen research for music across the country. And there's something about the Ottawa River that changes everything between English Canada and French Canada, or Lower Canada, as it were, historically. Musical tastes are just different once you cross the Ottawa River. That's it. That's my theory.
It's a good one. It's tested and true.
When did you come out on the air, and when did you come out amongst everyone else?
As a woman with a wife, you mean?
Yeah.
I never have.
On the air.
Come out, actually?
Yeah.
I don't think I have. I referred to getting married when I did, 12 years ago. So I didn't come out on the air. I have a memory of a conversation with a longtime listener who has called for years and years and still does, and texts and stuff like that. But in the conversation with him, I had gotten married by that point, and he was calling to congratulate me. And he said, congratulations, your husband's a lucky guy. I said, my wife. He said, your husband. And I'm thinking he thought that I was talking about myself as the wife. And I said, no, no, my wife. And there was silence. And he went, oh, okay. And he was affected. And he said, it's okay, Daryl. We're good. It's fine. He's like, yeah, okay. And then we got off the phone. I didn't talk to him for a little while, but then he called again. And he started calling again. So he just needed to adjust to his image of me and what I meant to his life. He himself in a relationship and living his life and doing his thing. But whatever I represented as Sharon on the air has now changed somehow. Or for that moment, it did for him. But it hasn't since, because ever since we got back into the routine of him calling, he'll always say, and still now, if I play his calls on the air, he'll say, I love you, Sharon. I never came out. I've referred to being married, and I'm mindful of it because I'm mindful of that reaction. But now, I think probably over the course of the last year and a half of doing trivia, Sholmes Rock trivia on Facebook, I'll refer to Deb. She's popped into the screen, you know, to bring me something or whatever. So people know, but I'm not out. People who know me know, and people who know what I believe in, I think know that too. I've never really brought much of like political beliefs or anything super personal. And yet I feel like I've brought a lot of my life to my job.
I don't think in Montreal you need to come out. You just are who you are. I mean, that's the kind of place that it is. It's just, it doesn't matter there.
No, it's true. And I think I have friends, older friends who had a more difficult time in their own careers and lives and whatever coming out where it wasn't as accepted and open and stuff like that. I think back to that whole confidence thing. I wouldn't ever let anybody tell me how to live based on what they wanted. So if you don't like it, you don't have to like it. I'm still going to do the same work. It's still going to sound as good or as, you know, whatever, whether you know my personal life or not.
I think Pete Marrier told me.
Pete Marrier came out to you? Ha ha.
I think we were talking about boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever it was. And then Pete looks at me and says, Matt, think about it for a sec. Sharon, have you ever seen her with a boy? I'm like, I don't know. I just never really thought about it. Maddie, come on. Matt, wake up. Come on. You know about Tom, right? Wait, Tom's gay? I was like, oh, Matt, I just don't pay attention to anything. Like, I just never think about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the conversation, it was, you know, I was like, really? I don't know. I don't really think about this stuff.
And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Because the people that have an issue with anybody's preferences or lifestyle or whatever, the stuff that bothers them, I think, is the stuff that's none of their business in any relationship. You know, like having to get your head around something that doesn't make sense to the way you were raised. That's you. So go and figure it out, make sense of it, and then come back because we're all fine over here.
Then I remember also we went out, we were drinking, and it was like 1 a.m. And I think Blair and I sort of egged you on to go make out with another girl, not knowing anything, of course. And then said, fine, but you two got to make out as well. And then years later, we were like, God, that was a little bit easy for her.
I remember that night. And there wasn't a full-on makeout session. It was leaning over and lip-locking, but that was it.
I'm glad you pieced that back together for me.
And that was the other thing, too. Going out socially, as I was single at the time, so I couldn't, and I had to drive back to the West Island, I might have had a beer. That's it.
Yeah, I had a lot more than that. By the time 2008 rolls around, Standard is sold as an entire company, and then you move over to Astral, and then eventually from Astral, it goes to Bell in a period of a couple of years. What happens in there that I don't know about?
Investment options. No, you know what? It was one of those, like I said before, you go through one of a company change and you're like, oh my God, I hope that doesn't happen again. And then it happened those times, you know, things once again. And then you get into the nitty gritty of fine tuning the team and people getting let go. And you're brought into meetings where we hope that doesn't happen again. And then, you know, 6 months later, it's happening again. What happened, I think one of this is so petty and silly. One of the standout things for me when we were bought by Astral was that they wanted us to change to Outlook from whatever email we were using before. And what we were using before was good. I just don't remember what it was, but it was good. And I thought, why does everything have to be the way they do it? You know, like silly little nitpicky things like that. And I thought on a broad stroke kind of thing, they're buying this property because it's successful. why are you changing stuff? Because that's the way you do it. I mean, email was a silly little example, but there was other little things that happen that they're changing because that's the way they do it. And it's going to be successful. They didn't buy us to save us. You know, we were successful entities when they were assembling their pieces. So that's always struck me as odd. Like, why are you changing things just because that's the way you do them? It might not be effective. I think it's important to look at what they're doing as consistently effective and maybe consider those. But there were some things that changed along the way based on that notion. Well, we've bought you and this is how we do things. And certainly Bell did the same thing. But I think from my experience with Bell all these years is that I actually feel heard. They're fairly policy driven, but they communicate with their people regularly to a point where you have like modules that you have to complete to make sure that you're up to speed with, you know, how to behave and stuff like that in situations and in the workplace and within COVID and, you know, if there's a fire in the building, all that stuff. But they're actively pursuant of that upkeep, which I appreciate. I can say that I appreciate it. I find when I forget to do a module and I get an email saying, you forgot to do it, I find it annoying, but it's my bad. I didn't do it yet, that kind of thing. But ultimately, what they provide to us as employees, I appreciate the information.
You've been at the radio station now for 25 years. That's crazy. You've seen many incarnations of the morning show. We talked a little bit about Steve Anthony earlier, Pete Marrier. Terry DeMonte has come and gone about three or four times from the show morning show. And again, he's gone again. Speak to mornings, if you could, about the people who've gone through there and what show mornings means, you know, in the various incarnations of the morning shows that you've seen.
Well, I think Terry had his longest run or one of his longest runs these last 10 years. So I think as far as recent memory goes, you can speak to that experience of mornings. And even within those 10 years, there was changes and tweaks and things and elements of making the experience better for the listener. Ultimately, what it boils down to, no matter what you give them feature-wise or personality-wise, it'll always be the music that they're listening to first. So whatever you can do to complement that, great. I've been fortunate enough to fill in on mornings over the past couple of years, and it's fun. Like the energy is all the listener. So it's the same with any show. You're tapping into what you think people are doing at that time, and you're serving that. But the activity of the listener with the station in the morning, especially, is on and on social media, and they're texting on their way to work. Pete's in mornings now. Easy Money is the feature that we're doing. Simple. Listen for a song. The payoff will come when you're the right caller through when you hear the song. It's simple, but it's something that people love to hear the reaction of winning a simple $100. And not to demean $100, it's not $1 million, but it's some people have that reaction just because they've connected with the station. They've won, they listened, their favorite song happened, whatever. It's amazing that those connections can happen so simply. It doesn't have to be complicated. And it does start with the music. And a feature like that, I think, totally proves that. Here's the one song you're listening for. They'll never forget that song that they won that $100 with.
You do realize that there's a petition online to get you instituted onto the morning show, right?
I do know that, yes. And I appreciate that. I love that someone who I don't know personally made it so that other people would sign a piece of paper to get me there. It's supremely flattering. And it's one of the most organic things that you watch that happen. You're like, wow. It's flattering because it feels like you've had some kind of an impact on their day.
We had Rob on a couple weeks ago, and it's tough to get Rob to talk to for just an hour about his career because I could go 2 hours and we could add a third hour if we got some scotch. Anyway, during the whole talk, we talk a lot about CRTC policy and Shulme and the history of Shulme and whatnot. But this was pointed out by Susan Knight out in Vancouver, and it's a tweet. And as you listen to the podcast, not a single woman was mentioned in the stories of Shulme. And we predominantly talked about Shulme in the 80s and before. And she goes on to say, it reminds me how hard it is to forge a path when you feel like an outsider. And, you know, it really got me thinking about Shulme and the women who have been on the air there or not necessarily on there, even worked elsewhere. But I think of Hillary McLeod. And one of the first persons that came to mind was Kathy Coulombe. You know, I grew up listening to her and then I got to work with her. I think of Christine Long.
I just saw Christine.
I mean, she's a reporter now for CTV and she's still in the building where you are. But, you know, she and I worked alongside. I love listening to her on the All Night Show, and so much so that I got to do it.
Yeah.
And work alongside her. But here you are at 25 years. I mean, I look at, you know, what you've done, and I put it right alongside Mistress Carrie at WAAF. You know, I'll probably mention Donna Halper, who back in 1974 was a music director, I believe, at WMMS and started playing Rush and put that on the air. Are there any others that come to mind?
I think in my own experience of coming to the station and getting to work with Patty, Peppermint Patty, she as a woman in the business, it's almost like you don't hear a lot of women saying, oh, it's tough for us. You know, there's not much griping when women get together about it being tough. It's the job. I think that for the most part, people that have been in it somewhere near my range of time, they just know. There's no question it's a boys' game, boys' club, whatever you want to call it. But like any club or game, you do your best to fit in. And I think that part of what I've done over the last 25 years might be classified as under the radar, but I'm proud of the work that I've done. I know the connections that I've made. And I know that there's few people that have lasted at a radio station as long as 25 years without leaving. I joked with Too Tall a couple of weeks ago when it was, he called me on the anniversary date. And I said, we're all just trying to catch up to you. You know, like he lasted 40 years on show, which is really cool. But women in broadcasting, being at Algonquin College, there were 7 females in the class and not all 7 finished. But Sandra Plagakis, she's a morning host on
KISS 105.3 in Ottawa.
Exactly. And I can say that as much finesse as she has as a broadcaster today, she was very close to that then, that many years ago in school. So it's no surprise that she did the path that she did. She's a talented broadcaster. Similarly, though, but not a woman, Mahler and the Rush on Hot 89.9. I graduated with Mahler also. So we had a pretty good class of broadcasters.
Yeah, he stole my name.
I know. You were Mahler in Edmonton, weren't you?
Yeah. I was there first. I haven't gotten a single check from him.
That was the funniest thing, though, the bear format that required some kind of bear name. Like, that's weird, man. I get it, but
it worked. You know, people say, hey, what's with Grizz and Mahler and Cub and Sled Dog? And then the PD said, okay, now name 4 people from another radio station.
Yeah, no, I get it. But do you need 2 Mahlers?
One was in Ottawa and the other one was in Edmonton. So that was spaced out far apart. I mean, this is long before the internet.
You're too gentle to be a Mahler.
Not when I was on the air.
Oh, no, eh?
Oh, no, I've leveled out. I'm more even keel now.
Well, that's good.
So tell me about the building blocks of rock. How do you put that together? I know you were kind of a little bit shy about talking about it because there's a freeform element to it, but I would never guess that it's freeform, although I know it's freeform.
It's freeform in spirit, but selfishly, I want to make sure that when I start that show on a Sunday that I'm buckling in and going for the ride. So I don't want to be like, oh, what am I doing? What am I going to put here? Like, I'm not planning every single detail, but I arrive knowing what's going to happen. But the fact that I have that freedom with that show to assemble what's going to happen is such a charge. So I sort of position it as it's a Sunday morning companion. So it starts at 9 o'clock. But granted that, you know, people with young kids have been up for hours already by 9 o'clock. Other younger listeners are just getting up, you know, or might have missed the first hour of the show. The joke is that it's the fastest 2 hours of the week, which it truly is because it starts at 9 and by, you know, the 10:20 break, like what? We've only got this much left. It flies by. It's fun. I love it myself. And I want to make sure that I can say that, you know, because I think that what I'm doing by assembling it is making it something that people will actually enjoy. Give them things that they don't hear all the time. And not that there's anything wrong with hearing things frequently, but playing stuff that was huge or maybe a one-hit wonder memory or something that like will get them to text things like, wow, I can't believe you played that. In this day and age, with the options that you have, I take that as the highest compliment. I can't believe you played that. Because technically, you could get that anywhere, but they're listening to the radio. So I want to make sure that it's something exciting and something a little different than what they would normally get, which I am 100% behind what we're doing on Shome. I think we're super hitting our stride musically. Our music department is on it and I'm loving it. And the 2 hours on the Sunday morning, I think gives roots to that.
You know, one of the things about Shom that I didn't realize when I was there in the early part of the 2000s was that the people in the building would still be there 20 years later. I'm looking at you, Jason Rockman, who, you know, I knew as a musician beforehand, but is now on the air. And Bilal has been doing afternoons for quite a while now. It's almost like you cannot work at Shom unless you've worked here for 15 years.
Yeah. Like it's contrary to what you ever heard about radio, like, oh, it's never going to last, or who knows, you might have to go here and then you're going to have to move again and whatever. But it's not been my experience, not the experience of the people that I work with. So,
yeah, even with Randy and with Pete and you and Bilal, I mean, it's the same cast of characters largely that have been there for a long time. It's kind of cool.
Well, it's neat that it totally feels cool. And the feedback that we get in general, the tone is that people know you. And people get to know what you do versus what somebody else does. You know, I can't believe you did this, or it's so cool when you did that. And when you think of how a radio station functions, which is that there is a music department, there is percentages of music that we have to play, meaning the hit, non-hit, the Canadian content, that kind of stuff, all that is taken care of in general. So if someone can say, let's say if I'm filling in for Randy, which I'll do next week, and someone says, oh, it's different when you're on. It's not. Like, the music is still being programmed by the same people. It's just the personalities present differently, which is neat because, again, it's the music department that's giving us the basis of greatness to work with, and we're all bringing something from ourselves to align with the listener. It's neat that that experience still happens. I appreciate it.
What do you think the next 5 years for Shom are going to look like? And you're welcome to say, like, the last 20.
I think, like I said, musically, we are hitting our stride still. And it's Pierre Landry and Marjorie Lacroix that tag team up. But Pierre's the lead as the music director. And Pierre's a longtime guy, too. He gets the city. He gets the vibe. He gets the listener. And he knows the music. So to have that kind of a focus that's also open to new things and whatever, I think the next 5 years with people that are in place now, I can say that because I don't think anybody's going anywhere that I know of. I think it's just going to keep on getting good. And I think that coming off of COVID and not the connections that we made, because the connections were already there, the attention to those connections, the two-way street of, as announcers, appreciating people listening, which we always do, but the love that we got back from people that were suddenly working a lot from home by themselves, different scenario, able to listen to the radio, choosing to listen to the radio, and being very complimentary with that communication. I'm going through this and I appreciate that you guys are there. That has come to the surface a lot within the past year and a half. And it's been, it's amazing. It's nice because, like I say, and I've said this on the air, like I'm in a room by myself talking to who knows who, you know, you hope it's a lot of people and you hope that you're reaching, but you don't know, you can't see them. But then you get text messages like that, where you've impacted someone's life in general moment in that morning, or help them with by saying someone's birthday, things like that, that have been somehow minimized in other cases, have been totally the benchmark of how we can connect with our listener. Make it about them without making it not only about them. We had a PD once that wasn't down with mentioning people's birthdays because it's only their birthday. But it tells the other listeners that you're listening. Someone said it's your birthday. Oh, I heard it was your birthday. It's such a niche little thing that has the potential for a nice ripple effect of, oh yeah, they did that for her or him or whatever. It aligns them with us.
There's a reason Facebook does it. It's because it creates engagement.
Yeah, but we knew that already. So it's kind of one of those things where you'd have this I told you so moment that you can't really have. You just knew. And so you have that pride of, well, I knew that already. I knew that my boss was wrong in that moment. Nothing you can do.
Sharon, congratulations on 25 years. At the legendary Shom 97.7, it's a tremendous accomplishment.
Thank you.
Of course, typical me, I go, oh, can't believe it. Because it's been 25 years, and I don't want to acknowledge that 25 years has gone by like that, but...
It's crazy. Really, honestly, 25 is a big number, nice, divisible by five, which I love. But to think of myself 25 years ago and all the stuff that's happened within the 25 years, it's like it's really given me a cause to like stop and think a lot, but really in a positive way.
Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Time flies, eh?
Sadly, yes.
The Sound Off podcast is written and hosted by Matt Kundle, produced by Evan Serminski, social media by Courtney Krebsbach. Another great creation from the Sound Off Media Company. Imaging courtesy Core Image Studios. There's always more at soundoffpodcast.com.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all had.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.